Alan Kring Productions presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, Academic Lectures in Business and Economics. This is Business Finance, FIL 240, Section 1 for Autumn Semester 2016. Lecture 24, delivered on December 1, 2016. The title of this lecture is Capital Structure.
Today, capital structure. Last lectures, again, I won't make you do any homework or quizzes or tests online for this one. So just be straight up. There's some math in it, but I'm not going to hold you for the math on the final. I'm going to hold you for the conceptual side of this. But I will show you the math anyway. Difficult. Subject in a way, but it's actually surprisingly simple. Here's the deal. You can, as a corporation, you can acquire capital in two broad ways. There's debt and there's equity. Now that's, of course, somewhat simplistic because on the equity side, there is internally generated equity, and then there's externally generated. In other words, in finance, which is a branch of economics, economic profit is a cost to you. Economic profit is a cost. That might seem like a counterintuitive, but the reality of it is that when you earn money at the bottom line, as when a corporation, I should say, earns money at the bottom line, that belongs to the shareholders. That means that they are a cost to you because you have to give it to them, either as dividends or as plow back into the company. You decide that you're going to have many children with a woman, I would hope. But, sir, the thing of it is that they are bundles of joy for maybe 3 or 4 minutes during their entire childhoods. But the problem is that you have to spend on them. You have to use your money for them by law. Law that is implied in law, implied in fact, implied in custom, those kids are a cost to you. So when you earn money, it's not yours, it's theirs. Because they're the principals and you are the agent. You remember that before you get all gooey-eyed about having kids, okay? I can't emphasize this enough. Accounting takes you to that bottom line, the word profit. We take you to the unfortunate consequence of that, that your economic profit, that corporation's economic profit, belongs to the shareholders. They are therefore a cost. That's why internally generated equity is a cost of capital. We designate that one, well, depending on what book you're using, where, who you're lecturing from, we designate that cost, that component cost of capital, by the letter K sub S. It's a cost too, and it's actually a surprisingly high cost too. It can range anywhere. I mean, you know, when I used to do this in the real world, and when I'd done it in the classroom, you know, I see a number. But then when I actually did these calculations for actual companies to see what the cost of their shareholders was to them, you know, I was looking at numbers that were in the 20, 30% range for the internally generated, what those shareholders cost you. Now, the externally generated is the cost of new capital. If you get new shareholders, If you get new shareholders, and we designate that one sometimes case of N for new shareholders. In other words, if you sell new stock to get money, you are embracing new owners. That will cost you somewhat more, depending on your float cost. It can just kind of like, it can really surprise you how much that externally generated equity is. And it all is hinging on the float cost of the capital. I'm almost tempted to just simply write the formulas out for you here, but I'll do that. I'll write the formulas in a minute. I'd really rather you know this on another level. Now, debt. I've told you, you probably already knew this, that debt comes in different flavors. There's the senior subordinated, junior subordinated. There's all kinds of different debt out there. We kind of do this one more like a lump amount of money. The reality of it is, though, the debt is cheaper than equity because it has the prior claim on the cash flow, so the risk to the investors, the lenders, is not as much. But there's another reason, too. If this is the cost of debt right here, say 8% coupon rate on it, then the actual cost of debt to the company after taxes is the cost of debt before taxes times 1 minus the company's marginal tax rate. In other words, because you get to subtract that interest expense before you calculate taxes, that interest expense becomes a tax shield to you. Now, here's the thing about that. I think I already did this rant, but I'll make this rant one more time. We have a progressive tax system, which has all kinds of good reasons for why we should have it, a progressive tax system. But one of the worst parts of that is as the marginal tax rate goes up for a corporation, in other words, as it makes more money, as it becomes more profitable, as it becomes huge, that T, the marginal tax rate, goes up. So 1 minus T becomes a stronger amount of tax shield. A large corporation has cheaper debt, all other things being equal, than a small corporation. For me, being in the low tax bracket, debt is not nearly as inexpensive to me as it is to a large Fortune 500 company. That means that they are getting a benefit from their hugeness. And in many cases, that hugeness comes from a lack of will to enforce antitrust law in this country. Those companies are big because we sit on our fat asses as a government and do not crack down on monopolies. So they get huge, and their tax rate goes up, and so they shield more of their income by taking on more debt, which, of course, makes them riskier, which, of course, makes it more likely that there will be an instability in the long run in the system. The more of those giant corporations with huge debt burdens you have, the more likely you are that something is going to break in that domino chain, and lo and behold, Yahtzee. But anyway, that's my bitch. And also, this applies to individuals, too. Rich people have high tax rates, so they can afford that they benefit more from mortgages on homes. So, in other words, our treatment of tax deductibility of interest on debt favors rich people and upper middle class to own homes differentially over poor and working poor and lower middle class people. Home ownership is a benefit of wealth, not of poverty. So there you go. We have a tax system which allows deductibility of interest expense, and therefore it embeds ipso facto an inequality in the system. Okay, so this, also I should bring up something here. I talked about the cost of internally generated and externally generated equity. But I didn't talk about the cost of internally generated versus externally generated debt. I mean, there really isn't a distinction here. Even when there is, the float for debt, in other words, what an investment banking firm, you go in to raise $500 million in equity. The investment banking syndicate's going to hit you for a pretty serious nickel. The float as a percentage is going to be pretty high, okay? 8%. I mean, if you count in all of their accountants, all of their lawyers, all of the dancing around, the expenses and the per diems and all that, you could see upwards of 12 to 15% of the price that you commanded for your new stock issue not even get to you. That makes it a very high. But interestingly enough, if you were to go in with a $500 million new issue of debt, I mean, the float cost is really low on that. I mean, it's surprisingly low on debt, comparatively speaking. I mean, after all the smoke is cleared, maybe 12% on you, after the smoke is cleared, maybe 2%, 1% for debt. It's just that's the way it is. Interestingly enough, and this is I actually did not know this until maybe about 5 years ago, that preferred stock issues have a very low float cost. That 12%, if you did that with preferred stock, it would be like debt. And I don't know, well, I do know why it is, because institutional investors just gobble those things up immediately. But the other reason, what really mystifies me is why that doesn't make preferred stock very attractive to companies. Remember I said that preferred stock is not really very favored these days by companies as a source of capital? And the mystery deepens because, I mean, preferred stock is cheap to bring up, cheap. Now, to give you a really a personal view on the cost of new equity. In my time as a consultant, I did several different things. Some of them were really just technical stuff, filing forms for companies, setting up so that they could get stock ticker symbols. Another side of it was dark. It was rainmaking. Do you know what I mean by rainmaking? When I say the word rainmaker, do you know what is rainmaker? Do you know? You don't know? Say it? Yeah, well, definitely had to do with money. It's when you bring money to the table. In other words, you need $10 million. You come to us, and we'll see what we can do for you. That would be a combination. If there is a pile of money that is flowing through our reach, we might be able to help you. If you are a company that interests us, we might be able to help you. And finally, if you are willing to pay out the nose, well, actually, it's a much lower part you will pay out of, we might be able to help you. All three of those have to come together at the same time, and then I could make rain with my partners. To give you the example, I might have already told you. Did I tell you the story of the jet company that wanted to get started? It was in the 90s, maybe 95. And the two young men I worked with, who were very well connected to money, I didn't ask where, but I should have at the time. They said, we've got a possibility down in Atlanta. There's a guy who's operating out of a trailer at the airport. A trailer at the airport? Yeah, but you got to hear his story. So we went down there. It was dark. It was nighttime. It was winter, but it was not that cold down there. And out in the back part of the airport at Atlanta, there were all of these kind of like scattered trailers and planes and different states of disrepair, and we went to this one that was well lit and opened it up, and inside was just stacks of manuals, just stacks all over the place. And sitting at the back of this table was this man with these piercing blue eyes, this gray beard, and this long gray hair. And he was sitting there with a cigar. And he had already spoken with my two partners. And he just, so they just walked in like they owned the place. And we sat down. His vision, his idea was that he was going to gobble up a bunch of decommissioned jets from Lufthansa. And he was going to convert them into couriers to lease out to take packages for DHL, UPS, and USPS on consignment, on a leasing basis. In other words, he would be the outsourcer for airplane flights of packages for the big parcel carriers. That was his vision. He already had the preliminary agreements with everyone to do it. He had Lufthansa agreeing to lease the planes to him, sell some, lease some others. He had the agreements of DHL and UPS to do their flying of some of their packages. Amazing stuff. But he needed to put the money on the table for the leases for the planes. I'm not going to tell you the actual number, but I'll say $5 million. Okay. Well, we talked for a while, got to know each other. For some reason, he liked me. He kept talking about, we started talking about airplanes and flying, and I had been a pilot. And he said, you have the vision of what airlines can do in the 21st century. And all this, airplanes and all that. So anyway. So we worked it out, and at the near the end of our conversation, the two Momo boys, the young men with me, said, okay, we'll bring together $7 million, and that'll get you your $5 million. And he said, wait a minute, $7 million? Yeah, $7 million. Oh, God. Wait, where's the other $2 million? Oh, that's ours. That's our cut. Okay. He just had a fit. He just... What the hell are you talking about? He used stronger language than that. He just flipped. And so we knew the routine. We just got up and we said, thank you for your time. And we all just walked out. And the younger of the two boys, Danny lagged behind Jeff and me as we walked to our nice car. We the two of us rushed. Danny lagged. And, of course, that was for so that the guy could come out and catch up to Danny. And Danny said, wait. And so they stood over there and they talked. And then Danny comes running back to us. And we did pretend we were talking. And we pretended for about 5 minutes. And we made some loud noises. And Jeff threw something. And Dan put his arms out like this, and I was just standing over there just shaking my head. And finally, Jeff turns around, and he nods, and then I nod to Danny. Danny runs back to him and says, all right, $6.5 million. And of course, he was so grateful. He said, absolutely, yes, please. I want this to happen. I want my dream to happen. You understand the float on $5 million, $1.5 million on $5 million? That's a staggering cost of capital. I mean, you're talking about a cost of capital of 30% about, just because this man wanted his dream to come true. So that gives you an idea of what the cost of equity capital can be. He was raising owner's capital, and it was going to cost him out the ass to do it with us, because we were going to take most of his company's stock. We were going to take a cut of consulting fee of $1.5 million to bring the rain down on his little enterprise. So that gives you an idea of how the cost of equity, and we were going to be expensive to him on the long run, too. Every time he made a dime, we got 3 cents of it. We weren't going to let him get by with not giving us money along the way. So there you go. Anyway, by the way, the deal did fall through. As it turned out, the FAA found out that this guy had actually been arrested in 1983. He was caught by the DEA flying a DC-3 into an abandoned airfield in Louisiana carrying an entire plane load of marijuana. Well, His story was that he had been paid to do this by the CIA because that was the way with a three-step from Iran to Nicaragua to the United States. They were funding the guerrillas in Nicaragua to fight the communist Sandinistas by selling arms, raising the money through the sale of pot in the United States to get the money to buy the weapons from Iran to sell them over to Nicaragua. Okay? Did any of you ever hear of this scandal? It was called the Iran-Contra scandal. And he was just a stupid-ass mule who happened to get caught by the DEA. And he said, I was the CIA. Guess what the CIA said? Oh, no. What are you talking about? So he had been busted, so the FAA wouldn't let him start an airline. Damn, it was a good deal, and he was an excellent pilot. He just should have watched out for the headlights down there on that airstrip that night. But anyway, okay, here's your cost of capital right here. Your new stock, your internally generated equity, and your cost of debt. Now, you put those together in what is called the capital structure. The capital structure of a corporation is the combination of debt and equity that funds the company. The combination of debt and equity that funds the company in terms of total assets. The combination of debt and equity that funds the company in terms of total assets. In other words, the total assets, you remember from accounting, total assets equals debt plus owner's equity? Yeah, this is the capital structure. In accounting, it's numbers. In our world, it is actually something that you watch for. So in other words, if your total assets are $200 million and your debt is $40 million, and your equity is $160 million, your capital structure would be 20% debt and 80% equity. That would be your capital structure. Now, in the next lecture, I'm going to tell you about optimal capital structure. There is a point on the debt-to-equity line that has the lowest weighted average cost of capital. Now, let me explain that. Here, the weight of debt is 0.20. The weight of equity is 0.80. Now, in a simplistic framework, let's say that your debt, the cost of debt is 8%. The cost of equity, your combined cost of equity is, let's do an easy number here, 25%. And this company's marginal tax bracket is 30%. The first thing before you would do anything else is that you would have to get the after-tax cost of debt, which would be 8% times 1 minus 0.30, which would be 5.6%. So then, the weighted average cost of capital for this firm would be 20% times 5.6% plus 80% times 25%. I have the sense I was born with, I would have done that calculation before this. 0.56 times. Oh, I'm sorry. You don't have to do it that way. Duh, duh. Okay. 0.2 times. I can't see worth a darn today. Times 5.6 plus. 0.8 times 25%, 21.12%. This is your weighted average cost of capital. Now, interestingly enough, though, some companies will actually set their weighted average cost of capital as their hurdle rate. That's insane to do that. That's madness to do that. But it's done. Another thing about this, notice how the more your company is equity, the higher your weighted average cost of capital is going to be because debt is cheaper than equity. Now, I'm going to have to qualify that with the next lecture. Because there comes a point where debt is no longer cheaper than equity. It's when debt, you've taken on so much debt that any blip in your sales could put you into bankruptcy. But for all intents and purposes, equity is actually a very expensive form of capital. It's one of those things where you see companies that have no debt or hardly any debt in their capital structure. And the question you have to ask yourself is, why? Are you nuts? First of all, your weighted average cost of capital has got to be high if you're using almost pure equity. And then the other part of it is that you are not achieving the gains to leverage. Debt is the way you make your owners rich. You don't make your owners rich by not using debt. You make them rich by leveraging. And that's the term, by the way. The word leverage is used in a number of different ways in finance. But in this way, leverage simply means using more debt. In other words, your fulcrum is back here so that you can actually lift more weight. You can cause your shareholders to make a lot more money with debt than with equity. And I'll show you what that means right now. Why we have debt and how you can make a fortune. I believe I showed this to you earlier in the course, but I think it will probably be a higher impact representation this time than it was the last time I did it. But before I do that, there's a downside to debt. You have to pay it back. And if you don't have the income to do it, well, then you're sunk. So, for example, about 80% of you in this class have at least some debt that you have taken on for this education. Am I right? Some of you are going to have a staggering level of debt when you come out of here. A couple of you are sitting there shaking your head. Nope, I don't. That's good because... Look, I've got great students come out of here, and they are pulling. I mean, my jaw is dropping at some of the salaries that are coming out here. Even in fields that we used to kind of laugh at, human resources, suddenly it's the pay coming out is great. Of course, out of accounting always, finance definitely, management, if you've got a specialized field within management, yeah, even marketing, if you get that quantitative analytics thing that we're doing now, they're pulling these salaries, 45, 50. Oh my God, an HR just pulled 62. One of our finance majors last year pulled 74. So as long as you've got a lot of money coming in, you rolled the dice, your bet was good, then you can pay off those student loans, even when the loan amount payment every month is staggering. You can do it. But some of you won't. You, for example, you thought you were going to get an incredible job when you came out. You applied to a lot of places. It was getting closer and closer. No one was hiring you. You had chances, but my God, you've got to have a job when you get out of here. Your parents won't help you. My God, you've got all these things that you've got to pay. Student loans are going to kill you. So finally, you have to accept that job as the assistant manager at a Jiffy Lube on the south side of Toledo. It's not the worst job in the world because you met a guy named Jake, and he'll help out a little bit when he can. He's in construction, which is off and on, but he's got about $20 a week he can put into the refrigerator and food. Okay. Yes, living the dream. And then you, sir, you were thinking that you were not going to do very well, but you get an incredible job paying you $64,000 a year. You negotiated from 62 to 64, and you decided that you were going to go for the gold. You took the job. Everything's great. You can pay your student loans. You can barely pay your student loans and still afford that 1983 Pacer, GMC, AMC Pacer car that you love so much. Okay? Good. Rolling the dice, the lottery of life. But let me show you what gains to leverage can actually mean. You, sir, you're an astute person. You want to make a lot of money. I've heard you invest in the stock market, but that hasn't worked out for you all that well. Some of your investments kind of went south. I mean, they paid off in the long run, but that company that started selling chia pets, it didn't go very well for a while. But anyway, you're an astute person. What you want to do, and you, sir, are too. The two of you want to buy a house for $100,000. You, sir, do not believe in borrowing money. Neither a borrower nor a lender be. So you have 100% equity stake. You, sir, are a playa. You are going, okay, in a relative sense, okay. Don't take that too far. Okay. I can't see you wearing a hoodie and all that. Okay, so here's the deal. What I want from you is a number. 80%, 90% debt. Does 90% sound okay to you? Borrowing $90,000, is that okay? You're a gamer. Okay, $90,000 in debt. So you put in only $10,000 of your own money. Okay, that adds it up, right? You're both gonna have your house, which you're gonna keep for a year, and you're going to flip. In a market where there's this is the price now, the price in one period is going to be $110,000. There's a 10% price appreciation. Okay, now, you borrowed money at 8%, and you are in the 25% marginal tax bracket. Okay? So let's work out the numbers here. For you, debt payback, interest, and then the after-tax interest what we have here for you is there's no debt to pay back. You just have your initial investment Okay. You have no interest to pay back. You have no after-tax interest to pay back then. Therefore, your total investment is just the $100,000 plus these. $100,000 So your net gain is $10,000 110,000 minus 100,000. Your net gain. Therefore, your return on equity, your ROE, is simply 10,000 over 100,000. 10%. Now let's go with the other person. The debt payback, he's going to have to pay back $90,000. The interest on that was 8% on $90,000. So the interest is $72,200. But it's actually only 6% because the 8% times 1 minus 0.25. So in other words, he's actually paying only 6%. So in other words, $5,600 is what he's going to pay back net in interest. Net in interest. So the total investment he made is going to be, well, let me put this up here. He's going to have to pay back $95,600. He's also going to have to pay back the $90,000 principal to the bank. So that is his earnings. His net, $5,600. He has to pay back the $90,000, and he has to pay the after-tax interest, which is $5,600. So when he pays back the $90,000, he'll pay back the $90,000. And what was his investment? What was his investment on this? So he got $110,000. Let me do this. $110,000 minus $90,000 he has to pay back, minus $5,600. So his total that he has to pay back, his net gain would be $14,400 is his net gain after he's paid back the principal and the interest after taxes. $14,400 is his net gain. Now, what was his initial investment? What was his equity investment? So his return on equity would be <laughs> 144%. That is gains to leverage on crack. Look at that thing. Now, if he actually had $100,000 like the other guy, his smart move would be to buy 10 houses, finance each of them with the $10,000 of his own money and the rest of it on borrowed money. And by the time he was finished with one round of this, he could retire on what he had done. Oh, well, he couldn't retire, but I mean, this is how many rich people have made themselves rich, is doing this trick. The whole thing revolves around bearing risk. You see, with you, you have no risk. I mean, if the thing falls apart, if the housing market goes tap city, you are fine. All you have is an ugly house that you can't sell, right? It's not that ugly either. It's in Toledo, okay? Anything better than a house trailer is decent there. No, I shouldn't say that. You, on the other hand, if the market goes south, you owe the bank all this money. If it doesn't go up in value, you are screwed, okay? They will. Remember what I told you happens? Equity can't do anything to you if you lose. It can yell at you. But you remember what I told you in the very early part of the course, what debt holders can do to you? Do you remember it? They can shoot your dog, sell your Bible on Craigslist, and make your mother wear furry costumes. That's what they can do to you. You are destroyed if this goes south, okay? That's why you need to make absolutely sure that if it goes south, your butt is covered. But, in a way, it is here. Do you know why your butt's covered? Why this isn't going to hurt him at all if he's smart? Do you know why? How can you do this so that it doesn't hurt you? Even if you lose, you win. You're okay. You just walk away. You incorporate so that when the bankruptcy happens, it happens to the company, not to you. You go on smelling like a rose, collecting management fees out the wazoo, and eventually you can actually run for public office. That's as far as I'll go with it, but that's exactly how it's done with many of the people who present themselves as rich and powerful and famous and genius. No, all they've done is a trick like this, and on the times when it turns south, they walk away. They've already collected their salary for their rich from the company, and they let the lenders eat the loss, and they just go on to do another project. If it wins, they win because they were on the equity side. So if you do it right, even in the downside, you win. If you do it wrong, you really can get destroyed by this, as a lot of people did. This whole thing, by the way, I don't know. I can't remember whether it was around or not, but in the 1980s, it was a huge thing. It was called creative financing. And there were these infomercials that were offering to tell you how you could do it and make a fortune. And truth be told, you could to a certain extent if you played it right. But unfortunately, a lot of people didn't do that step where they separated themselves with that wall from the debt that they were taking on. And that wall was hugely important to protect you from. If you don't have a corporate veil, everything comes to you personally and you're just wrecked. But if you have a corporate veil and you've just kept the money separate and you just take your salary and all that and don't play, do a game where the court can pierce the corporate veil, you'll come out smelling like a rose. So remember that corporate veil. Why corporations are so important, and why we can see such incredible active development and building in our lifetimes. It's because the downside risk to the equity players is very low. Have you ever noticed how around this town, how restaurants come and go, a restaurant will disappear? And did you ever notice that they usually tear down the old restaurant and build a new one in its place instead of using the existing building? Look around. It's obvious why they do that. That just creates more possibility for gains to leverage. The more you spend, the more likely it is that you, the higher the win is if it all works out. And if it doesn't work out, well, you just go on to another game in the next round. It's very much like video gaming. It's if you do it right, it's not like it's not like real warfare. It's just you get killed and you just reset to play it again. So that's why you'll see companies, instead of using an existing restaurant, using an existing building, they will find some lame-ass excuse. Well, it's behind code, or we can't accommodate what we expect to be our... Oh, no, it's not. That's not why. It's so that they can have more money to invest. They have more need for money, more capital, and that's what keeps our economy growing at the staggering rate that it does, even as large as our economy is. And other economies do it too. China's figured it out, as well as us, and other countries are too. But anyway, that is all I have for you today. I thank you.